Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If you're still licking your wounds after Pluto's downgrade to something less than a planet, take heart. There may be something far bigger out there that, if confirmed, would mean our solar system contains 9 planets after all. That is, at least 9. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Astronomers have some tantalizing clues about what some are calling Planet 9 or Planet X, strange behavior by space objects in the far reaches of the solar system that would seem to point to the gravity of a planet 10 times the size of planet Earth. But confirming the existence of this mystery planet has proved surprisingly challenging, and despite all the excited chatter, it's possible it simply does not exist. Science writer Michael Lemonick is here to talk about what we do know about this new contender for ninth planet status. He is opinion editor for Scientific American, and his article, Hidden Planet X Could Orbit in Outer Solar System, appears in the February issue of the magazine. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Glad to be here.
What were the first clues that there might be something big in our solar system that we had not previously accounted for?
The first clues came from some very small objects, smaller than Pluto, that are more distant than Pluto. They're members of the Kuiper Belt, which orbits the solar system, ice-covered objects that are flying around out there in the darkness. And some astronomers noticed a couple of years ago that the orbits of about 12 of these were behaving peculiarly. They seemed to be aligned in a way that couldn't easily be explained. And the best explanation they could come up with, or at least one plausible explanation, was that there was something much more massive out there whose gravity was shepherding these objects into those alignments.
Tell us a little bit about, just for some background, the Kuiper Belt and what it has to do with this and these objects.
Okay, well, in 1930, Clyde Tombaugh discovered the planet Pluto, and at first people thought it was very odd. Here's this small, icy body orbiting out all by itself at the edge of the solar system. You know, we have giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and then, like an afterthought, this little tiny chunk of ice, ice and rock, and they thought that was very odd. But what they've learned since then is that it's not alone at all. There are millions and, in fact, billions of smaller objects orbiting out there with Pluto. So that's the Kuiper Belt. It's where many of the comets come from, and it's where an object known as Eris was found in 2003, which eventually deposed Pluto as the ninth planet, because Eris was about the same size as Pluto. And so the question is, do we add a planet or do we subtract Pluto? And ultimately, it was decided to subtract Pluto. But we now know this Kuiper Belt is filled with objects that are left over from the origin of the solar system.
What is Sedna, and what made its discovery so groundbreaking?
So Sedna is the first of these strange objects with strange orbits that was found by astronomers. A guy named Mike Brown and his collaborator Chad Trujillo found this thing, and it is a lot smaller than Pluto, but it is in a very distant orbit. It's much further out, and it orbits in a very elongated orbit. Its orbit is stretched out much more than anything we've seen aside from a comet. And so that was a kind of a mystery object. What is it doing so far out there? How did its orbit get so stretched out? And nobody really knew. And so the idea was maybe we will find more of these. We will look for more of these. And about 2 years ago, Trujillo and a partner named Scott Shepard found a second object, something like Sedna, also with an elongated orbit. And they also noticed that there were some smaller objects that had been discovered in between, which again had these very elongated orbits. And Sedna and this new object, whose name is too long even to pronounce, and these smaller objects all had this strange alignment. So Sedna was something peculiar. This new object a couple of years ago was another peculiar thing. But when you get to 12 of them, then you start thinking you're seeing a pattern.
So, Mike, if we can observe these objects that are behaving in peculiar ways, why wouldn't we be able to directly observe something as large as a planet that they might be tied to by gravity?
It's because it's so much further away. So its gravity is enough that it can influence things that are not really very close to it. And it is far enough away that even though we think it's big, and by the way, we don't have definitive proof that this thing exists because it hasn't been seen. All we have is this very strong evidence. And it's big, but it's very far away. It's very cold, so it doesn't glow with its own light. And it's just simply too hard to spot something like that unless, with the biggest telescope in the world, you're looking directly at it. And unless you know where to look, that's going to be very, very unlikely.
Right. And talk a little bit about this, because we can, you know, scan the skies with our big, powerful telescopes. But of course, you know, what we can see goes in sort of a cone shape as we, you know, originate on the Earth or near the Earth.
Well, I'm not entirely sure what you're asking, but I mean, the sky is enormous. And to search carefully every square degree of sky, looking for such a faint object and looking to see if it moves, because if you see something faint, you don't know if it's a faint star halfway across the Milky Way or a giant planet within the solar system. So you have to see it move. And so to find something very faint that moves very slowly across the sky and understand that it's a planet and not a star, you have to use a lot of telescope time on the world's most powerful telescopes, and people have a lot of things they want to do with these telescopes. So finding planets is only one of them. So basically, sky surveys have been done across most of the northern and southern sky looking for objects like this, but it takes years. And again, it moves so slowly. Something like this would be so far away. Its orbit would take it something like 10,000 years to go once around the sun. And so to see it move at all, you have to look at it over and over and over again. It's just a daunting task. Unless somebody says, you should look right here. This is exactly where you'll find it, which is how we found Neptune and how we found Pluto. And so now scientists are getting an idea of exactly where to look.
When Tombaugh discovered Pluto, he was correct that it existed, but incorrect about its size by a lot. What led to that calculation error?
Basically, he spotted it with a relatively small telescope. He made assumptions about how bright its surface was because, you know, you can't actually see Pluto, or you couldn't in the telescopes of the 1930s. Or pretty much any telescope even existing today as a disk, you just see it as a spot of light. So how big it is depends on how bright it is. So you assume that if it's brighter, it's bigger. But if it's made of a particularly bright substance, like if it's covered in ice, it's brighter than it would be if it's made of rock. So if you put the moon out where Pluto is, it would be much, much dimmer, even though it's not that much smaller. So he made assumptions. And also the calculations of its distance were not really that careful. They were not that precise. And so it was just an overestimate. They thought at first it was bigger than Jupiter, which was pretty impressive. Now they know it is really tiny.
You know that the idea of a real ninth planet has been ridiculed for a while. Why has that been the case, and what's changing recently with this talk of Planet X or Planet 9 that makes a lot of people take it more seriously?
Well, it's been ridiculed to some degree, but the first time anyone said, hey, there's a Planet X out there, they didn't use that term, but they said there's another planet out there we can't see and we should go looking for it, was in the 1840s. And what they did see was that the planet Uranus was orbiting strangely. It sounds familiar. It sounds like what I was talking about earlier. And yes, so the orbit of Uranus wasn't, so the timing of how it was moving around the sky seemed off. And theorists suggested maybe there's something else out there we can't see or haven't seen whose gravity is pulling on Uranus and altering its orbit. And they said, here's where we should go look. And observers went and looked. And sure enough, there was Neptune right where it had been predicted. So the very first instance of a Planet X turned out to be a wild success. Nobody ridiculed it at all. It was a very powerful demonstration of this technique of looking for unseen objects whose gravity is pulling on other things. So that's why the search for Pluto began, because people looked at Neptune's orbit and Uranus's orbit, and both of them still seemed off. And so a guy named Percival Lowell built an observatory, a very rich guy, built his own observatory in Arizona, and it was designed to look for this missing planet. He's the one who hired Clyde Tombaugh, who was actually a farm boy who had no education, but he was passionate about astronomy. And he got Tombaugh looking at the sky. And long after Lowell died, Tombaugh found Pluto. So this was sort of a vindication, again, of this idea. So again, Planet X was not a crazy idea because there it was. Turned out to be a little crazier once everyone realized that Pluto was so small it couldn't possibly have been affecting the orbit of those giant planets. And ultimately, people realized that the anomalies they thought they saw in the orbits of Neptune and Uranus were not real. That was a mistake in the first place. Nevertheless, so now we've got two instances where astronomers went out looking for Planet X and found a planet. So it really wasn't that crazy. More recently, astronomers have claimed evidence for yet another planet. See, the thing, it's always called Planet X, right? Because X stands right. for the unknown. People, in fact, have criticized this story I wrote for Scientific American, saying, well, why do they call it Planet X? X is the Roman numeral for 10, and you're calling it Planet 9, and that's very confusing. Well, X doesn't stand for 10. It stands for unknown. So people proposed yet another Planet X. So in the 80s, an astrophysicist at Berkeley proposed that it wasn't just a planet. It was actually a dim star, a very dim star that we hadn't ever seen, that was sending showers of comets down on Earth every 26 million years or so. And that explained the death of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And people looked for that, and they didn't find it. So that cast a little doubt on this Planet X idea, the modern version. A few years later, actually a few years ago, a couple of astronomers suggested that comets themselves seemed to come preferentially from one direction in the sky. It wasn't a very strong effect, but they thought, well, maybe there's something like Jupiter out there that is pushing comets in toward the sun, and that's why there are more coming from the direction of where this planet might be. So people went out to look for that also, and no, that's not there either. So it's been up and down. It's been up and down. But the idea that there could be a significant size planet out there that we haven't seen yet has never gone away, and it's not really that implausible. And that's why astronomers are saying, look, if you give us some evidence, we will take it seriously. And now they're getting that evidence.
We're speaking this hour with science writer Michael Lemonick, opinion editor for Scientific American, who wrote an article called Hidden Planet X Could Orbit in Outer Solar System that appears in the February issue of Scientific American. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science writer Michael Lemonick, opinion editor for Scientific American, who's just written an article for the magazine called Hidden Planet X Could Orbit in Outer Solar System. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org with your questions, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Mike, it's really interesting to think about the fact that, you know, as we send up these more and more powerful telescopes, we have the Hubble, soon we'll have the Webb, we are finding exoplanets in, you know, distant solar systems, and there are still so many mysteries within our own.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we sometimes talk about the fact that the bottom of the ocean, bottom of the Earth's oceans are less well known than the surface of Mars because they're so unexplored, and it's the same kind of thing. You know, our solar system is much closer, but there are things we're finding around other stars that we have not yet found in our solar system, and one major reason is that the way we look for planets around other stars is different from the way we look for planets in the solar system. You know, here we look to find to see these planets directly, to see actual images of them. With planets around other stars, we look at the planets' effects on their stars, on the starlight. And so it's a very different technique, and it's not one we could really use here in the solar system. So that kind of explains why it's sometimes easier to find a planet around another star than it is here.
So if I understand correctly, because we are between our star, the sun, and the possibility of a planet X, we can't look and see that, you know, the sun's light is dimmed because we're right there in the middle.
Exactly. So that's one of the techniques we use to find exoplanets. You watch as the planet passes in front of the star, and the star dims a little bit. Well, we actually can look and watch Venus pass in front of the sun, and we've seen that many times, but we know Venus is there and the sun doesn't dim all that much. But for a giant planet, we know it would have to be on the wrong side, and so there's no way to use that technique.
What can we learn by close observation of stars that seem to resemble the sun that are in other parts of the universe?
Well, I mean, one thing we can learn is whether there are planets about the size of Earth, about the mass of Earth, and at about the right distance from the star to allow water to be liquid, which we think is a requirement for life. So we can certainly look for planets we think might be Earth-like. And as new telescopes like the Webb come online, we will increasingly be able to look at the atmospheres of these planets to find out if there are chemicals in those atmospheres that suggest the presence of life. So there's an enormous amount we can learn by looking not just at the stars, but at the solar systems we find around them.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Michael on the line in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. My question, when I read the story in the newspaper and I heard that these objects out there were being influenced by gravitational forces, I assumed it was dark matter or dark energy, this stuff that we don't know what it is. And I was surprised to find that they decided it was a planet, huge, that we've never seen or perceived before. And I just wonder if you could say, why would you think it's a planet instead of dark matter?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, the reason is that dark matter is much more spread out. So the dark matter that is in and around the solar system is very, very spread out. It's like we're in a fog of dark matter, and it's only when you get to very, very large scales, like the scale of the entire Milky Way, where all of that dark matter adds up enough to have an influence. So this looks much more like a concentrated chunk of matter of some kind. And when we talk about a concentrated chunk of matter that weighs 10 times as much as Earth, planet is really the only thing we know about.
Some people think these odd effects that are being observed in these objects in the Kuiper Belt could be the result of galactic tides. Can you explain what those are?
Well, yeah. All the stars in the Milky Way itself is rotating around its center, but each individual star follows its own path. So it's like a rushing stream. Each drop of water doesn't go in exactly the same straight line down a stream or a river. They move around and they kind of wander, and they all go in more or less the same direction. Same is true for the stars in the Milky Way, and we know that we're pretty sure that the sun, as it moves around the core of the Milky Way, it bobs up and down very slowly, passing through the most dense part of the plane of the Milky Way, passing by interstellar gas clouds, and every time it feels more gravity on one side than the other, which is not that rare, that pulls gravitationally on our solar system, and it can set up movements of planets, movements of objects. It can push things around. And so one idea is that if you see unusual patterns in objects, especially out at the edges of the solar system, it may be that they're feeling tides from a nearby interstellar gas cloud, and that could explain some phenomena.
Does the position of the Milky Way itself change within the universe, other than the fact that it's being affected by the sort of gradual expansion of the universe?
Sure. The Milky Way feels gravity of other galaxies. We're actually the nearby Andromeda galaxy, this very large spiral galaxy that's kind of like a twin of ours, is pulling on us, and we're pulling on it, and we're actually pulling each other together. So as the universe expands overall and the distances between galaxies get larger overall, the distance between us and Andromeda is actually getting smaller because our gravity is influencing each other. And in a few billion years, we will probably crash together. So yes, we're moving around not just in the expansion of the universe, but also under the influence of other very large concentrations of matter.
Hmm. Would a Planet X, if confirmed, effectively redraw what we have understood to be the boundaries of the solar system? I'm not sure how that works exactly.
No, it would not. So we know that far out, even beyond where this Planet X might be, we have a vast spherical cloud of icy chunks, not the Kuiper Belt, which is much closer in, but something called the Oort cloud, which is made up of things that would be comets if they got knocked loose and fell toward the sun, and we know that sometimes they do. A passing star, for example, that gravity of that star can knock a few of these things loose. So that is much farther out than Planet X. It's maybe almost a light year away, a quarter of the way to the next star, Alpha Centauri. And so the solar system is far bigger than Planet X is just like a close neighbor compared with some of this stuff.
We have an email here from Danny in Frisco who wants to know, will the upcoming James Webb telescope make it easier to determine whether this is a planet or not?
The James Webb is actually not the ideal telescope to do this. It's big, but it's not nearly as big as some ground-based telescopes. And its field of view is pretty narrow. And you want a pretty wide field of view because, as I said earlier, it's so hard to look carefully at a little tiny patch of sky and then another little tiny patch and another tiny patch. Much better to have a telescope with a wide field of view like the Subaru telescope in Hawaii, or a new telescope called the LSST that will be going online in Chile in 2018 or 19. And if ground-based telescopes are oversubscribed, the Webb is going to be fantastically oversubscribed. Everybody wants their hands on that. So people who want to find Planet X would be fighting with every other astronomer on Earth to get some time to do that. But it's just not the ideal telescope for it.
How much of the analysis of whatever it is these telescopes that we have these days feed back to us is analyzed by human eyes, and how much is now, at least in the first pass, left to, you know, computer technology to look for aberrations and changes?
I think that's a good question. I think it's mostly computers now. I mean, when Tomba found Pluto, I can't remember how many tens of thousands of photographic plates he looked through to try and see if there was any movement of any object from one night to the night 30 days later or whenever. You know, he was looking for motion. We're looking for such faint objects, and I can't imagine that the human eye would be a very good tool for doing this.
The number, the size that we've heard being discussed, bandied about with regard to this possible planet out there that you and I are calling Planet X, it's been 10 times the mass of Earth. If we don't know what it is, we don't know exactly where it is, is it simply the gravitational effect that it's having that says it would be 10 times the mass of Earth?
That's exactly what it is. So you've seen the story in Scientific American, but that was written last summer, long before last week's news came in that there's new, stronger evidence for a Planet X. So it was good timing for us, I have to say. And the very newest evidence, the news that you heard last week that this thing is more credible even than it was last summer, came from an analysis in which astronomers said, look, we don't know what this is. You know, what could it be? What is making these objects behave badly? And, you know, what if it's a planet? Let us do simulations in which we try every combination of planet mass and orbit that we can think of. That certainly was done by computers. And they kept trying and trying and trying. And the thing that best reproduced the effects that they saw was this planet of about 10 Earth masses in this particular elongated orbit. So when they guessed that size and that orbit, the results in the simulation looked like the results in the sky. That's how they're narrowing it down. It's the thing that best explains what they see.
And is anybody talking about, is anybody speculating about the possible composition of this planet? Would it be rocky like Earth, or would it be made of gas?
It would certainly have rock at its core, because all of the planets we know of do. Pluto we used to think was a big chunk of ice. Now we know it's actually more rock than ice, but there's a very thick ice coating. This object probably could not have formed out where it is now. Even in the early solar system, when there was a lot of gas and dust floating around, there wasn't enough material, or there was enough, but it was so spread out in this vast outer edge of the solar system, it probably never could have collected itself into something this big. So it probably formed much closer in, near where Uranus and Neptune formed and then got flung out somehow. And we're confident that both Uranus and Neptune have a rocky core surrounded by a thick blanket of gas. So this thing we think probably has a lot of rock. We are confident it also has a fair amount of either gas or, because it's so cold, ice. So when you look at Pluto, its surface is mostly ice because it's so cold out there that the things that make up the ice, the nitrogen and so on, can't stay in a gaseous phase. This object, this Planet X, or Planet 9, they're calling it, is so much further out and it's so much colder that almost certainly any gas that could form an atmosphere has condensed on the surface to make a thick covering of ice.
Do we know anything, incidentally, about what it's like on the surface of a gas planet, a gas giant? I mean, if you were to set something down, would it sink down until it reached the you know, metal or rocky core, or what would it be like?
Yeah, I mean, So the solid core of, and even Jupiter and Saturn, by the way, we believe have solid cores, or cores made of rock and metal, but the atmospheres are thousands of miles thick. And so you would, if you tried to set down on it, you would have to go through all that incredibly thick atmosphere. You would be crushed under unbelievable atmospheric pressure before you ever got to the surface.
Is there a size cutoff for determining what's a planet and what is something else? I'm thinking about, you know, the people are still up in the air, spun up about the downgrading of Pluto. How do we decide that this qualifies to be a planet and something below a certain mass or size doesn't?
Well, that's a very, very contentious question. You know, there is no clear scientific answer to that question. And
that is not the answer I was expecting from you.
Oh, yeah. No. That's why. So if you talk to Alan Stern, who's in charge of the New Horizons mission to Pluto, a fantastically successful mission to Pluto, he not unreasonably says, of course Pluto's a planet. Don't be ridiculous. Just look at it. It's a planet. It's spherical. It looks like a planet. It's a planet. Whereas Mike Brown, who helped to dethrone Pluto, and in fact I think his Twitter handle is @PlutoKiller, says no. It's not. You know, it's not a planet. It doesn't fit the definition that the International Astronomical Union has put together. So you get scientists claiming to make scientific arguments on both sides of that question. And the problem is that the word planet, that very word, is something that we invented. Nature didn't invent that. Nature
right.
didn't, you know, doesn't go looking at these categories we've made up and say, well, you know, I've got to be consistent here. You know? And so we try to make sense of the universe by coming up with categories, but nature doesn't care. So on Earth, Australia is a continent, but Greenland is an island. Why? So who decided that? Well, you know, there's no strict cutoff. It's just somebody said there's got to be a cutoff somewhere. So we'll choose this one.
Michael Lemonick is my guest. He's a science writer and opinion editor for Scientific American. He's just published an article in the magazine called Hidden Planet X Could Orbit in Outer Solar System. If you've got a question or want to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Scientific American opinion editor Michael Lemonick. His article, Hidden Planet X Could Orbit in Outer Solar System, appears in the February issue of the magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. What are the chances, Mike, that a planet we already know about, like Neptune, could be exerting some sort of force on objects not quite in its vicinity, but on the objects that are behaving strangely?
Not good. Mm-hmm. So when we go back 2 years to the time that people found this second object like Sedna, and by the way, there are about a dozen others or about 10 others that also fit into this category, and that's why we think there might be a planet X. Other observers and theorists came in and said, you know what, of those 12 you identified, probably about half of them are behaving this way because of Neptune. So let's take that out of the equation because they shouldn't count. So you're right in that sense. But even when you take those out, the ones that are remaining could not be influenced by Neptune. So that's why we still have to go with a Planet X explanation as the best one.
What would it take to definitively confirm this thing?
We'd have to see it. We'd have to see it, or we would have to find many, many more objects that it's influencing. So if you've got a half dozen or so, which is about where we are now, that's very strong evidence, but it's still only a half dozen. If we got 30 or 40 and they all fit this pattern, it would be increasingly difficult to say that it's not a planet. And people are searching actively for those, just as they're now searching actively for the planet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go now on the phone to Jean in Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I wanted to find out if with the new planet that they have and the elliptical orbit that it has, would it have any effect on planet Earth? And I've also heard that the moon is slowly moving away from us. Would it have any effect on that? And how would the moon moving away from Earth affect the planet?
This thing is too far away to have any influence on Earth or on the moon and its motion. It's just too far away. And unless you're an astrologer, and I understand that they're very excited because...
Astrology, you're saying, not astronomy.
Astrology, yes. Mm-hmm. And the horoscopes haven't been working out. And maybe there was a planet missing, and now they're happy. But scientists, actual scientists, would say no, it has no influence. And the moon is moving away from Earth very slowly. It will have, as this continues to go on over millions of years, it will have an effect on our tides. They'll get lower, the orbit of the moon will – a month will get longer. It'll take longer for the moon to go around the Earth. This is nothing we're going to see in any human lifetime or 1,000.
Will the Earth someday be moonless? Is that a possibility?
Good question. It's a possibility, not necessarily because of the moon moving so far away it's no longer connected to us, although I guess that's possible. But there's also the fact that in about 5 billion years, the sun is going to swell up into a red giant star, and it's going to reach close to the orbit of Earth, and so we will be completely fried, and the gravity of this expanding sun, who knows what it'll do with the moon, but we won't care because we'll be
long gone.
Toast, yes.
All right, 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Reggie on the line now in Irving. Hi, Reggie.
Hello. I have just a basic question. With the success of the New Horizons probe at Pluto, I just had a basic question as to how they're able to get such dazzling photos if the object is so far away from the light source, being the sun.
Oh, it's because the cameras are so incredibly sensitive to very faint light. They're just exquisitely sensitive. So they're like... I was going to say what they're like, but I don't even know. But they're just extraordinarily light sensitive electronic cameras. And if you were there with your eyes, it would be much, much, much dimmer than what you're seeing in those cameras.
And some of those images are treated, with an eye toward accuracy, but artists work on them, right, to kind of enhance them so that we can study different properties of things that are spotted in space.
Are you talking about Pluto or generally?
In general.
Yeah. So in general, I wouldn't say artists exactly, because that implies a license that scientists probably wouldn't take. But yeah, images are certainly enhanced to make you easier to see contrast, for example, in colors and so on. So if you were out floating in space, looking at some distant galaxy, you would not see it, or if looking through a telescope, I guess you don't have to go float in space. If you're looking with your eye through a telescope, the images you see are not nearly as colorful as what you see from the Hubble Space Telescope, because as you say, those are color enhanced to bring out the contrast and also to make them prettier, because the Hubble people like you to look at their pretty pictures and go ooh and ah.
How would, if this thing is, and it's so strange to be talking about such, speculative science at this point, but if there were confirmation that this thing existed, what would it change for people who study our solar system?
Well, by looking at what's in the solar system now and how it's orbiting and where it's located, the people who study planet formation theory can deduce how it all began. So how our solar system was born and how it evolved into its present form, And the discovery of the Kuiper Belt back in 1991 or 92, when the first objects after Pluto were discovered, has gradually taught us that there was a period early on, a kind of a violent period, when Jupiter and Neptune and Saturn and Uranus shuffled around in their positions and changed their distance from the sun by many millions of miles. And that shuffling and realignment is what flung these Kuiper Belt objects out to where they are in the first place. So this discovery of the Kuiper Belt revealed that our solar system had a more violent early history than we had thought. It's the same kind of thing. If there is a planet out there, then we have to say, how did it get there? And how it got there might tell us more about the early days of the solar system and what went on then.
And these Kuiper Belt objects didn't coalesce into something like a planet because they are far enough from the sun that the gravity didn't pull them together? What was the reason for that?
It's that they're so far apart from each other.
Okay.
Right. So if you look at the asteroid belt, which is between Jupiter and Mars, it's a bunch of rocks flying around, and they didn't coalesce into a planet because the gravity of Jupiter kept disrupting them every time they tried. But if you imagine that you took them all, but they could otherwise, right? So if we didn't have Jupiter, they would have formed into a planet. Well, if you took them and flung them all out to the outer edges of the solar system, they're the same number of them, but they're much more spread out now because it's a much bigger area. They're so spread out, they wouldn't come close to each other often enough to stick together and form anything bigger. And that's the story of the Kuiper Belt. The stuff is just so far apart that the pieces aren't going to encounter each other very often.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Ray on the line in Rainbow. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
Great. Go right ahead, please.
Oh, I had a question. I see some stuff on YouTube talking about Planet X and possibly it coming into the Earth's orbit. And he's talking, the stuff I've seen, just to be honest, is as close as in a couple of months. And I've heard other things, and all of a sudden I hear you guys. So I'm kind of curious, do you think it's that close to us and coming into Earth's orbit or not?
No.
It's very far
away. Not a chance. And there are people who claim that there's this mysterious planet out there, and I think it's called Nibiru. It was going to destroy the Earth a few years ago, but somehow it didn't, and now it's going to come in again. It's completely made up. It's imaginary. Actual astronomers just laugh when they hear about it because it's just so nonsensical. And yet it gets a lot of play on the Internet, and it sounds plausible, but no.
We have an email from Ben who wants to know, is it possible that farther out there are more planets? Could there be a 10th or an 11th planet?
Yes, there could. There could. So people have done surveys with infrared telescopes in space and decided that there's no planet as big as Jupiter within 50,000 astronomical units, which is 50,000 times the distance from the Earth to the sun. Nothing as big as Jupiter out there, but things the size of Planet X, 10 Earth masses, absolutely it's possible. And if they're even further out, then they're probably not influencing objects we can see, and we can't see them very easily. They would be much harder to discover.
So gigantic telescopes, as you alluded to earlier, are very expensive. You know, everybody's got a project that they want to use these for, and decisions have to be made about where they will go. How much time, how much access does one particular scientist or group of scientists looking to answer a question get to a particular powerful telescope? Is it a matter of checking in once a month for a couple of years? Can you talk a little bit about what you know about that process?
Well, it all depends on a number of factors. One is whether their home institution or university has an ownership share in the telescope. So mm-hmm. The Keck telescopes in Hawaii are jointly owned by, I think, Caltech and the University of California, and then with some other partners. And so if you are an astronomer at Caltech, you get a lot of time. I don't know what the numbers are. I cannot really say. But you get a few days every month or two. Whereas if you're not, then you either have to partner up with one or you are stuck in the general lottery. And depending on how good your proposal is, your idea, and how many other people are applying, you might get a few days a year. So whereas if you're at the University of Hawaii, you get a lot of time on the Gemini telescope because you are you're in charge of all the telescopes on Mauna Kea. So it has to do with what institution you belong to and how strong your proposal is.
For the folks, Mike, who are looking to answer this question about whether there's a ninth planet out there, is this wave of publicity helpful in terms of getting them access, getting them funding that they need?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really good question. They would generally tell you no. They are most interested in their scientific peers reading scientific papers, and that's how you get noticed, and that's how you get your proposals accepted and funded. In recent years, I've gotten the sense from astronomers that it does not hurt a bit to be on the cover of Scientific American or Time Magazine or whatever, that publicity has more of a role than maybe it once did. So I think it's changing.
Knowing you and having spoken with you many times before, knowing that you wrote this piece about Planet X months ago before the newest wave, you're kind of on the cutting edge. What are you looking into next? What unanswered questions are exciting to you right now as a journalist?
Oh, boy, that's a very good question. I mean, I have to tell you that now that I'm working as an editor, I'm more focused on dealing with proposals from other journalists. And since I'm not writing a lot of stories myself anymore, I'm not really thinking along those lines so much. I mean, one thing I've become very interested in is not involved in astrophysics at all. I'm actually just finishing up a book on neuroscience on amnesia and memory and how memory works in the brain. And I'm really beginning to be very focused on that and trying to understand how our brains manufacture this entire world that we inhabit for us and allow us to navigate through it and how profoundly little we understand about how that works.
Your curiosity is perpetually expanding.
Yeah, well, it's the scientists who are doing all this great stuff. I don't have to do anything.
Michael Lemonick is opinion editor for Scientific American. You can read his article about Planet X in the February issue of the magazine. Michael, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for making time for us today.
My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Jeff Whittington is the show's executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think if you'd like to send me a message, or you can send an email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.